doing, man. Thank you. Thank you. Good evening. Good evening. Dr. Winston, thank you so much. Winston family, thank you so much for this wonderful opportunity to join you. Ron, I heard the 30 minutes as well. It reminds me of something I heard during my undergraduate days when members of the fraternity said, whenever you have something important to say in a short period of time to say it, all you really need to remember are the five B's. And the five B's meant, be brief, brother, be brief. So in conclusion, I want to thank you again. See, you're laughing because you heard speeches and you know they never heard of the five B's. I have a wonderful day job at Walgreens as the Global Chief Diversity Officer, first in its history. Walgreens, as you know, is probably somewhere in your neighborhood. And if it's not there, we're on our way there. So it is an honor to be at this historic company in such a meaningful and important time and place in our history. I think so much of what Ron was talking about, the intersection of good business and faith in the marketplace, is, I think, reflective of an emerging and new time for which we have to pay close and keen attention. The other reason you ought to listen to Ron is just not every day that somebody from Detroit comes to Chicago to talk about the Pistons. That's a courageous man right there. But what I want to do in my time is tell your story. Now, how is that possible? How is it possible? I don't know you and you don't know me, but I'm not going to tell exactly your story, but I'm going to tell a part of your story. Because we all have mutual chapters. We all have a story. Whatever that story is not evident simply by looking at you, although don't we all rush to those judgments. My story begins in this place, New Bedford, Massachusetts. I moved to Chicago 5 years ago. And do you know I talk funny? I didn't realize that I actually had an accent until I moved here, and Chicagoans would say, you're not from here. It wasn't a question. And so I would say, no, I'm not. I'm from Boston. And their response to this was to laugh. So I couldn't figure out what was so funny. I felt like that scene in Goodfellas. I'm a clown. I amuse you. This is funny. And so they said, well, look, you really don't need to say where you're from, because the minute that you start talking, we hear that Boston accent. So I'm going to slip in a few park the cars in Harvard Yard, because I want you to feel the full effect of a Boston accent. I want you to get cheated. So New Bedford, whaling capital of the world. Is someone from New Bedford here? Well, y'all going to be from New Bedford tonight by the time I'm done. But if you've seen the movie Glory, members of the 54th and 55th Regiment came from New Bedford. Yeah. It was also the first place that Frederick Douglass lived when he escaped from the South. So it has this amazing history of equality and access and opportunity, and that was, in essence, where my story began. That dashing, handsome fella there is me at the age of 7 years old. I am proud to report that I have since grown a neck. And I also have been cured of the virus that afflicted all children raised in the 1970s, and that was a giant cholera virus. You're laughing because some of you got pictures just like that. I know you do. But family, I saw this picture for the first time 6 years ago. It is the only picture that exists of me from my childhood. Hard thing to reconcile. Some of you took five or six pictures just while you were here tonight. But for me to look at this and see that that is the only picture that exists of me, that picture is hiding a lot of things, though. That by this age of 7 years old, I have been through so many foster homes that I've lost count. They are but mere shadows and reflections of being in somewhere and then out of there again. I am a collision of labels, an African-American boy with a blonde afro, a Polish last name, a light complexion, and blue eyes. And so every day I am asked, now what are you? And why do you look like that? And the answer my whole life was that I didn't know. No memory of a mother or father. No sense of ever being connected to anything or anyone. And when you're in the midst of that situation, well, you fall prey, which is how I found myself in so many different foster homes. I am called dumb and ugly and broken and beyond hope and beyond repair and beyond possibility. All these years later, I have a hard time figuring out how somebody could think that I am ugly. Don't clap at that. I'm only serious. But no child is ugly. No child is broken. No child is beyond repair. But you remember what you're called. You remember how people look at you. You remember what their eyes say to you that their mouth does not. So if you looked at me with pity or despair, I knew that you would not help me. And so I would step away from you and I would say, no, not you. I can't tell you the extraordinary violence that I am subjected to on a daily basis. I can't tell you that this foster family is telling this story of a broken boy that is not me. And your glance would tell me whether or not you were there. So the things that we see and say with our eyes matter. They matter. I was an inheritor of a tragedy that I didn't ask for and I didn't create, but God saw fit to make me responsible to change. See, Psalm 27:10 says, when your mother and father forsake you, it will be the Lord who will lift you. So let me show you how he does that. By the things that he puts in our life that says there's another way here. It came to me early from this little fellow, the little drummer boy. Christmas and Santa Claus didn't come to my house, but the little drummer boy did. I couldn't wait for the little drummer boy because, like me, he was an orphan, see? And so he was trying to find his way, his purpose, his place. So I identified with him. And I also liked these two fellas too. You know who that is. I won't make you sing the song, but I know you know it. Heat miser and freeze miser. So in the midst of all this struggle and all this adversity, I have this secret weapon that nobody knows about. And I wield it daily, unyieldingly, and without apology. And my secret weapon is that I love to read. I have to take great risks to read, though, because though it won't make any sense to you when I say this, one of the rules of this foster home was I couldn't be seen reading in your presence. So I had to sneak and hide to read. But that's what I would do. This spot right here was my favorite place, literally this spot. I grew up in a city, and to me, this retaining wall had been yanked out of a mountain and placed right there just for me. And that's where I am reading one summer morning when I hear someone coming. The other rules of this home was that I couldn't be seen talking to an adult. So when I hear someone coming, my prayer is that they will keep walking. Don't stop and talk to me. But the feet do actually stop and they say, well, what are you reading there? And I was so nervous, family, I just kind of held up my book and the feet say, Well, weren't you reading that last week, and shouldn't you be done by now? Now, how did this person who I'd never seen before, never heard before, knew that I was reading the same book over and over again? Finally, I mustered the courage to say, well, when I'm finished, I just go back to the beginning and I hope I see new things. The feet say nothing and they walk away. Later on that night, there's a knock at the door. Now, family, when you're in the midst of a struggle like that, everything matters. So when this voice, I'm in another part of the house, and when this voice says something magical, is Steve it? That was important because I was rarely called by my name. But I already knew at the age of 8 years old who that voice belonged to. It was the person who had stopped me earlier, asked me what I was reading, who I dared not look up and make eye contact with. And so I come running around the corner. Well, truth be told, I was eavesdropping a little bit. And I came running around the corner. I almost ran into what I now saw was a fairly small woman. Reason I don't run into is because she's holding a box of books that she would bring me that night, but also many days and nights throughout the remainder of the 12 years that I would remain in that foster home. So those books became like my armor. I went to church one time in my childhood because the family knew what would happen if I was in a sanctuary like this. They knew you could not be fooled. They knew that you would ask harder questions about what's going on with that boy. So I was kept away from there. But you know how powerful God is. All it takes is one time. So the one time I go, I'm a 10-year-old boy. They put me in Sunday school and they asked you, had you ever been to church before? I had not, which is how I found myself in the classroom of 5-year-olds who were laughing at me and pointing at me. And that's when the Sunday school teacher said, you know, you can talk to God every day if you want to. You don't have to wait till Sunday. So that's what I would do. So I am armed with my love of reading, but now I know I've got this other power called prayer. So because I prayed and read so much, it was more armor. What I want to be is a detective. See, I want to be a detective so I can figure out why I look like this. And then I want to figure out where's my mother and where's my father and why have I been left here. So these are the books that I would pour myself into, take any risk necessary to do it. But the more and more that I am getting emboldened here, the more resistance I am getting from this foster family because I am a source of income. As we move and as I move forward, especially in school, this is my elementary school, and that fella there with the arms crossed is me. Everything matters, though. I can tell you why my arms are folded, because that was a celebration of the centennial. And my classmates were ridiculing me for not being in a costume. And so those folded arms are defensiveness. But again, I still have some advantages here. One is my love of reading, which makes me quite a strong student. My classmates know, in fact, they say all the time, you know, we really don't need to have the spelling bee because Steve's going to win. And they're right. But this one time, I'm standing there, and you know, the spelling bee, you get the word over here, and then the judges are over here. And so you get the word, you spell it to the audience, and you look at the judges. So I would get the word, I would spell it, and then I would look to the judges. But every time I look over at the judges, there's this one judge who just keeps smiling at me. And it got to the point where I was so much more interested in her look than I was in getting the word right. So I would get the word, I would spell it, and then I'd look. That's how important she was, and that's that spelling bee judge. And that is the way that she looked at me. That look of pride. That look of, no matter what anybody else says, I see something that nobody else does. She didn't need to say a word. See, her look was sufficient. Her look was all I needed. So now I'm getting bigger in mind and in spirit because of that look. As I head off to high school, I have decided that I am going to college, and there's nothing you can do to stop me. But family, see, I don't know how to get there. I don't know what to do until a classmate of mine mentions, well, you can go to the Upward Bound program. See, they'll help you fill out the applications to get to college. I said, well, I don't really know how to even begin. He says, well, it doesn't matter. All you have to do is go into the office, and there will be somebody there to help you. In fact, the director of the Upward Bound program is there today, and she'll help you. So I walk into the Upward Bound office, and who is there waiting for me but her? Who says to me, I remember you, you're the spelling bee champ, and I swelled up again. So now, this is Ruby, and a Ruby she is. The family tries to stop me from entering into the program, but Ruby, who's on the school board and a titan in the community and a woman of deep and abiding faith, is persistent. She once again says, see, there's something here. I'm trying to tell you, I see something that nobody else does. I want him here in my program. I'm getting taller in spirit, though, more determined, because I'm going to college. See, I'm on a mission. I'm on a mission. Have been from the very beginning. But I find myself now really confronting the family, who's trying to do everything in their power to stop me, everything in their power. It's how I find myself seated 2 days after Christmas. I'm 16 years old, and I am bearing the physical scars of years of torture and a brutal beating the day that I physically escaped, believing that it would cost me my life, and it almost did. I'm sitting in front of my social worker, and I watched this man, born of good heart and good intention. I watched him for the better part of an afternoon call names on a sheet of paper trying to find a place for me to stay. But the truth is, I'm 16 years old. I'm black. I'm male. I have this story by this foster family of all the problems that I've got. And finally, social worker says, well, it's a holiday, Steve, and it's going to be difficult. And he finally says to me, well, do you know anyone? I remember thinking, I thought that was your job. But he was trying to help me, so I couldn't say that. But when I was in the program, I had overheard this teacher say to me, say to someone else about me, said, I don't have any children, but if I had a son, I wanted to be just like that young man who walked out of here. So when the social worker says, do you know anybody? I remembered what he had said. And the social worker says, well, you know, he's probably on break, so we'll just leave him a message. You know, it's 2 days after Christmas. He's not at school. But he is at school. He's there correcting papers, waiting for my call. And that's him right there, Mr. Sykes. You can see why things like these traditional categories of race and color don't mean a lot to me. The social worker says, can Steve stay with you for a week? Mr. Sykes says, absolutely. He says to me in that week, he says, well, what are you going to do? You know, what's your plan? I said, Mr. Sykes, I want to go to college. He says, well, you know, you're going to have to take tougher courses than the one that you're in, and I think that you can handle it. And I said, well, Mr. Sykes, AP English, that's for the smart kids. I don't think I belong there. And he said something most important. He said, why don't we try it and just see what happens? He said, but you're probably going to have to do some catch up from the first semester. I walked into the class and they handed me the syllabus of everything that they had read in the first semester. So in the first semester, they had read Moby Dick, but I had read that. And then the second semester, then the next book they had read was Othello. I had read that too. And then Great Expectations by Dickens, and I had read that too. And then they were beginning Paradise Lost by Milton, and I had. So Mr. Sykes says to me, I think you've been asking yourself the wrong question. The question isn't whether or not you're ready for them. The question is whether or not they're ready for you. I am going to college. I have no money. He says, well, why don't we apply for scholarships? I said, what's that? He said, think of it like free money. I said, well, what do you do? He says, you just apply. And so I applied, and I got rejected a lot because I applied for anything I could get my hands on, including Daughters of the American Revolution. They wrote me back a nice letter, said, no, we're not changing our rules for you. I wrote them back and said, are you sure? I'm trying to get to college. I don't think you understand. So I was told no a lot, but I was told yes a lot more, which is how I wound up with a full scholarship to Boston College. But graduation day, I'm still trying to solve this mystery. I'm still trying to solve it. So while it was important for me to walk across that stage, I still remember how quiet it was because there was no mother and father, aunts, uncles, that cavalry of family that shows up to those celebrations. And as I walked from one end of the stage to the other, I said, I'm going to find out where I've come from. It was nothing more than a dream that had always been in the quiet of my own heart, a sense that there was something that I could do here, something I could quite possibly change. And it took a while. It took a long while. But amazingly, magically so, I was able to find my mother and my father. You know, in their absence, I had dreamed of them, right? I had imagined, you know, all the things I would ask them about, well, what happened and why weren't you there? And I thought, you see, I thought I would actually be able to talk to them. Why did you name me Steve? And what happened to my twin sister? And what were you battling that you couldn't come for me? But they're not there, and all I have are just pictures to talk to and headstones. So though I came to meet them, I never came to know them. And you can see by the brevity of their life in between the dashes that their lives were brief and tragically short. Voice I've always heard from my mother and father that I will always hear for as long as I breathe air is whether or not I can live a life that will redeem theirs. I hear that coming to me, and though there was certainly a period in my life where I was so angry at what had been lost, I came now to see through what they so desperately wanted was just an opportunity. When I wrote the book, I remember social media, somebody saying of my father, what a waste of a life. And I remember thinking to myself, how can you say that when I am here? So I choose to remember my mother and father as the young children that they were. That is my mother, Marion, on the left, and my father, who, if you look really closely, you can see that he clearly just got in trouble for something. But that is how I choose to remember them, but we're all faced with a question that when that which you dream about and you aspire to doesn't come to pass, what do you do? What do you do? And the answer was one that I'd had all along. It was a mission I was on. I decided to build as best I could with whatever I had. And what I had was a love of learning and a great deal of prayer. And because of those things, new beginnings began. This individual to my left is my oldest brother, Ben. And that is my biological brother. If you walk through this door, you say, there's a white man. I wouldn't say that. I'd say, there's my brother. Who I wouldn't meet until I was 30 years old. And the next is all of the Pembertons, my father's family, who did not know that I existed. When he was killed, they thought that his life and his spirit was gone. And then 20 odd years later, I show up with no memory of him, but think a lot alike and have the same mannerism. So I've never seen a ghost, but I do know it's like people look at you and think that you're a ghost because of the similarities. But see, I had some things all along. I suggest to you that there's things that we all have that are just part of how we are and who we are. This next picture is somebody who I told you about already. That's the spelling bee judge. And this time she's not at a spelling bee, she's at a book signing. See, all that she poured into me, all that she saw in me, she's standing, and isn't she still smiling the exact same way that she first smiled at me when I was 8 years old, the exact same way. I also told you who these people were. Over the years, I had lost contact with the woman who brought me books. But some 35 years later, after she had given me those books, I found her. And I asked her, I said, so her name is Mrs. Levin. I said, Mrs. Levin, so why did you do that? I said, did you know what was happening to me in the home? She said, no, I didn't know. I said, so why did you do that? And she said, it was something my mother told me to do. Give from where you are with whatever you have. And all I had to give you were a box of books. But now you know that it was about a lot more than just a box of books. It was about vision and values and purpose and place. Small things matter. Small things matter. The next are all the things that are part of my life today that mean a great deal to me in some way, shape, or form. Walgreens and my team here. You want to wave? Where's my team? Here they are. My fraternity, which taught me a great deal about manhood and the number of children causes to which I must devote my life. See, I'm not extraordinary or special. It was because of all the people around me. And so things have a way of coming full circle. You don't believe me. Let me tell you how that happens. 2 weeks ago, I come to my office, and there is a letter waiting for me from a fifth grader from Massachusetts, several towns over from where I grew up. Very nice letter. Stunned me that a fifth grader would find me in Chicago, write to me, even though the wrong address is on the letter, it gets to me anyway. And he says a very powerful line in there. He says, though our stories are different, doesn't mean that we can't learn from one another and we can't be inspired by one another. A fifth grader. So Diane, you want to wave? Diane, my assistant there, is part of this. I said, so my eyebrow goes up and I get this like smile, that means I'm up to something. And so I said, Diane, I'm going to be in Massachusetts in the beginning of May and call the school and tell them that I'm going to come by and surprise him. So Diane calls the teacher and the teacher says, we didn't even think we were going to hear from you, let alone come by and see him. But what did I say before? Everything matters. And I was simply doing what Mrs. Levin had done for me, see, and what Ruby had done for me, and what Mr. Sykes had done for me. The teacher says, well, since you're coming to the school, I'm going to go talk to the principal about you talking to the entire school. I want you to envision a conversation between the teacher and the principal. The teacher is telling the principal about me, this author who wants to come to the school. And the principal's getting more and more interested. And at one point, the teacher has my book, and my picture is on the book. And as the teacher's holding it up, the principal says, let me see that. Let me see that. And she looks at the book, and she says, takes one look at my picture, and says, we will absolutely have him here because I was his second grade teacher 40 years ago. So now you know that things come full circle. Now you know that all along there was a plan there, all along, all along. And so as I think about the things that encompass my life, that encompass your life, I have told, in the process of telling my story, I've told some of your story too. Those mutual chapters that we share, that come across to one another when we simply take the time to listen. And so because I've journeyed into this world and I'll journey from it, and there's just some things I'm just not going to know. I'm not going to know what it's like to have and be of a family in that historical, traditional way. I'm not going to know what it's like to have a mother's love, a father's touch. That's just not part of what I've known. But I did have family, though. They just, you know, family doesn't always look like you. So all these people and places that's family. And because of that family, I now have this family. So it comes full circle. My wife, Tanya. My children, Quinn, Vaughn, Kennedy, who know a little bit of what Dad endured, but know that it's not to be repeated. It's not necessary. It's over. It's over. So lastly, however you've come into this sanctuary with whatever doubt might be in your heart about what's possible, whether it's starting your own company, whether it's trying to reconcile something that may be broken in your family, the only thing that you can quite possibly take from what I've shared with you tonight is that, see, it's possible. It's possible that we are not to be defined by our circumstances over which we have no say, but by our possibilities over which we can create everything, including no beginnings. I said a few minutes ago that I'll never know family in the traditional way, so you know what I do is I just kind of, I do something I used to do as a boy. I would envision myself, see, part of your family. I'd see you walking through the neighborhood, and I'd say, now, what would it be like to be part of Ron's family? I still do that. I still do that. I have my own, of course. So when I say thank you for having me here and for being part of your family, you now know the place that comes from. Thank you, and God bless you. Thank 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 you.